Over four decades as a recording artist, Neil Young has consistently refused to do what his fans and his record company expect of him. Much like Bob Dylan, he's followed his own path. He's famously reluctant to give interviews, and when he does, he prefers not to talk about his past. In 2012, he made an exception for BBC Radio 4's Front Row, giving the interview you're about to hear upon the release of his 33rd studio album, Americana. As well as discussing the album, which reinterprets a lot of traditional American songs, Young describes the process of working with his old cohorts Crazy Horse. He also talks about his political leanings, the current state of the protest song, and his ambivalence about playing his old material, saying, "Sometimes I like to please people, and sometimes I don't." I'm John Wilson with Radio 4 on Music, and this is Neil Young on Front Row. Forty years ago, a 26-year-old Canadian singer-songwriter topped the album charts on both sides of the Atlantic. Neil Young's LP, Harvest, outsold everything in America that year. I wanna live, I wanna kill. I've been a miner for a heart of gold. It's these expressions I never give. By 1972, Young was already a seasoned performer. He'd left Canada for California in the mid-1960s to form the band Buffalo Springfield. He appeared at the Woodstock Festival with the world's first supergroup, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. In 1970, when National Guardsmen shot dead four student protesters in Ohio, Young responded at once with a song. It was released immediately. Twin soldiers and Nixon coming, we're finally on our own. This summer I hear the drumming for dead in Ohio. Neil Young is a musician who's never taken the easy route and has sometimes appeared uncomfortable with superstardom. In his back catalogue, the delicate acoustic records sit alongside uninhibited electric albums recorded with the band Crazy Horse. Tonight, in a rare extended interview, Neil Young reflects on his career and his instinctive approach to songwriting.
I believe that the first thing you will hear in the morning when you wake up is probably the most important thing you're going to hear all day. Because you've been working on it all night and you didn't even know it. So whatever naturally happens is okay with me. And if I have something on my mind, it may come out in the song. Sometimes the songs are terrible. Sometimes I play them anyway.
For his latest album, Americana, on which he reunites with Crazy Horse, Neil Young has tackled a set of traditional American folk songs and reintroduced some of the dark and violent lyrical themes that have been lost over the years. When we spoke, I asked about the concept behind the album.
I am a poor, wayfaring stranger, while traveling through this world of woe.
Originally, I had no concept. I was just eager to record some songs with Crazy Horse, and I hadn't written any, and Crazy Horse and I hadn't played together in a long time, and we were anxious to play in the studio. But before that happened, I was writing a book, and I was writing a book that's sort of a memoir and sort of a diary that I've now finished.
Due out in the autumn, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I was writing about a period in 1964 where I was in a band called The Squires, and I was playing in a place called Thunder Bay, Ontario, in a club called The Fourth Dimension. And a band came through from New York called The Thorns, led by a singer named Tim Rose. Now, Tim Rose had arranged O Susanna in a way that was totally revolutionary to me, and it blew my mind when I heard it. So I copied it, and I showed it to the Squires. And it was really the beginning of folk rock. Tim Rose was right on the edge of this in 1964. You know, there was a folk rock movement just starting. But I had a drummer in my band, and he didn't in his. So when we did it, it was more rock and roll.
So you've played Oh Susanna before. You were playing it with the Squires in 1964.
In 1964. But also, I loved it so much that I arranged four or five other songs at the same time for the Squires. So we were doing about half of the Americana album in 1964.
Ah, right. So
as
you're,
the Squires.
Right. So you're revisiting your roots.
Well, I had all the arrangements. We had it all together. And we were playing it with that band. And then I decided, well, I'm playing with Crazy Horse now, and I was remembering these songs. And so I decided, well, I don't have any songs of my own, so I'll start playing these.
And some of them reach way back. And as you say, a lot of them are dark. There are a lot of murder ballads in there. We got
Yes, they're almost all dark. But they're just also the same songs that kids in America sang in kindergarten. Groups like the New Christy Minstrels and the Kingston Trio did as these happy-go-lucky folk songs. So all I did was go back, research all the original documents, and find the original lyrics to these songs, and reinsert all of the original lyrics.
So they've been cleaned up, lightened up in tone over the years. I mean, Clementine in particular, and looking at the lyrics.
Yeah, Clementine's a dark epic, and it bears no resemblance to what people are used to hearing.
A lot of people will remember Huckleberry Hound singing his version of that in the cartoon.
Well, there you go. You know, it's a famous song.
But
it's
I can't remember him singing, "In my dreams she still doth haunt me, robed in garments, soaked in brine, though in life
I used to hug her.
I used to hug her, now she's dead, I draw the line." A lot of morbid humor on this album, isn't there?
Well, it's very morbid. There's just a lot of depth and a lot of darkness and a lot of despair. These are the songs that kids grew up with, but they were missing all their biting ingredients in the latest versions. You know, another one is like This Land Is Your Land, Woody Guthrie song. I used all the original lyrics, and that's a protest song.
Yes.
So it's not so much a celebration of the geographic attributes of countries as it is a protest against the political systems and the cultural and social systems of the countries.
This land is yours.
Melodically, though, that is probably the most faithful rendition of a traditional song on the album, isn't it? Because very often, with Crazy Horse, you seem to be finding your way into songs, and Oh Susanna sets the tone, in fact, doesn't it?
Yeah,
rollicking pace and volume right from the outset. And, I mean, it struck me that you and Crazy Horse as a band of musicians, all in your 60s now, but the pace hasn't slackened, has it?
Well, you know, it's still the same band, and there's no reason to change. It is what it is, you know.
But what happens when you play together? Is there something unique to that band of musicians, something very intuitive that kicks in when you plug in together in a room?
Yes. There's no other way to explain it. That's what it is. It's a chemistry, and the chemistry is good. But more than playing the way we play, it also opens up a pathway for me as a writer and as an expressionist of the music. It takes me to a different place. I'm able to express myself in a different way, probably more free than a lot of the other things that I do. But I don't use Crazy Horse all the time because I don't want to abuse it. It's not something that you want to drive into the ground. It's like anything good. You want to keep it and take care of it and use it when you have to, but make sure that it's in good shape.
The album starts with that rattle of drums and a guitar sketching out a riff, and then the bass begins to set the pace, and it's as if you're not sure what you're doing. Is that how you were recording the album, feeling your way, literally feeling your way into the songs?
Well, the takes are all, you know, generally, I don't think there's many takes in it that are later than, like, the third take or something, so a lot of times we really didn't know what we were doing. But their songs are very simple. And they're very repetitive. So once we established that, then we just improvised the arrangements. And so there's a lot of the spontaneous thing going on because we're just making it up.
You're reclaiming some of these songs, which have become almost children's tales, songs, ditties to be sung round campfires. I mean, the track Jesus' Chariot, better known as She'll Be Coming Round the Mountain. This version is a long way from that sort of song sung by Boy Scouts. And it takes the song back to its gospel roots, doesn't it?
Well, you know, the song is about a chariot. The chariot is a female, and Jesus is riding in the chariot, and Jesus is coming back. And that's like the, as some people interpret it as a song of the end times and a song of the return of Christ. And so it conjures up a lot of wild images when you listen to it in context of that.
Yeah, it is a vividly evoked song, and bolstered by the noise of Crazy Horse. I mean, we get the sense that the horse, your band, is galloping in full flow, and it is a magnificent sound to that track in particular.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. And the choir is really good on that.
We
use the choir a lot in the record, and it's a choir of teenagers from a school, from a group of schools in Los Angeles that we put together, the Americana Choir, just to sing these songs with us. But I gave the choir the arrangements that I would have given Crazy Horse. And then sometimes we're singing on top of it, and the choir's always way behind us. They just give us this air of something else that's there. But we have a lot of depth with that choir, and they bring in, there's a lot of subtle presence in Jesus' Chariot with the choir. You know, I've played with a lot of bands, and they're all unique, you know, but Crazy Horse is completely in another class because of its roughness, and but the chemical thing is, and the groove, the chemical part of it, and the groove, and the fun we have, and how emotional we are about it, and how much it means to us. It's just real. There's just no other way to put it.
And are you freer as a guitarist when you're playing with that band? I mean, very often the solos that you take, I think, possibly are simpler when you're playing with Crazy Horse, but there's an emotional, there's a direct energy to the way that you play very often. And it becomes intuitive, and it reminds me of sort of John Coltrane in a way, that it's just, it takes its own path.
Playing with them, I'm totally free. So I take my liberties with the guitar and take my liberties with anything. And, you know, I don't have to play as many notes. It's just the easiest thing for me to do.
And your style of playing hasn't really changed over the years, has it?
Not really, no. It's basically the same.
Has it evolved? I mean, do you rein yourself in? Do you think, I know what I do well and this is what I'm going to stick to?
No, I don't think about it.
Right.
I just play. You mentioned Coltrane a minute ago. Like Coltrane is a great, great musician, as was Miles Davis. And some of the excursions that Crazy Horse and I have taken on our future records and on our past records are reminiscent of that sort of spirit of freedom. And that's where we live.
You say future records. This album is out now. So there is another record on the way then, is there?
There's another record complete that we did right after we did this record.
During the same sessions, I see.
Yes.
Right? Yeah, we'll of original continue. Neil Young material.
Yeah.
Ah. So what can you tell us about that record then? Or is it under wraps for the moment?
Well, I don't like to talk about it too much, but there it'd have to be a double CD because of its length. There's a lot. Well, there's one track on it that's 26 minutes long that's the longest one, but there are three other ones that are quite long, and then there's some regular songs in there. It's you know, it's just an extension of what we do. But when you mention Coltrane and I mentioned Miles Davis and everything, there are a lot of excursions on this record that go off in different directions, and where we exploit the freedom that we have.
Back to Americana. Perhaps the most surprising folk song on here is the one that closes the album, God Save the Queen, the British national anthem. It's been sung in your native Canada for 300 years or so. But an unusual candidate for the album Americana.
Some people would think that. But on the other hand, there was no plan with that song. I woke up one morning, I was singing in my mind, I was hearing God Save the Queen. And I'm going, well, how about that?
God save our gracious queen.
When I was a kid and I went to school in Canada, I used to sing it every morning. So I figured, well, okay, so I'm, you know, I'm programmed. I'm singing this song in my head, you know, walking around. And I said, well, I could do that. Well, we could, the horse could, we could play that.
But
and,
I,
you know, so
yeah.
We tried to play it and it was awful. We couldn't play it. And then we had to figure out what tempo it was in and figure out an actual arrangement. And I think we had to do like 6 takes or something to get it right. And then I added the choir to it. I could hear what I wanted as we were doing it. I knew the choir was going to be part of it. I saw it as an important part of the record because of the American Revolution.
Mm.
And the American Revolution was the, you know, Declaration of Independence and freedom of America, of the United States of America as a country. And they were basically throwing off the reins of the British Empire at that point. And interestingly, the song that is also a national anthem for the United States is My Country, Tis of Thee, which is sometimes called America, and sometimes, I don't know what it's really called.
Which has the same
but
melody.
But it's exactly the same melody.
Yes.
Now, where the melody came from is up for grabs. I mean, the history says that this song, God Save the King, was being sung in the 17th century. I don't know which one came first.
I guess in terms of Americana, it qualifies also because pre-revolution, pre-declaration of independence, it would have been sung by British settlers, just as the way that African-American gospel songs were sung, so therefore it became part of the musical folk heritage, that song.
Correct. That's the assumption I'm going under.
Yeah.
And I wasn't there, obviously, but I think that somebody sang God Save the Queen somewhere in the United States, and it was a very upsetting thing to some people, and they decided, we're not England, and we're going to have our own thing, and we're going to have a revolution, and we're going to disengage, and then we're going to have our own song.
Confound their politics, frustrate their empty tricks, on me our hopes we fed. God save the queen.
Interesting, you've gone for the verse that includes scatter her enemies, make
yeah,
them fall, confound their
verse.
Politics, frustrate their knavish tricks. Not one that you hear often sung at official functions here in Britain.
Yeah, but it was officially written in the first place, and it was the original lyrics. There's nothing to be ashamed of with that verse, and but it was dropped. It's actually quite a good verse. It's, in my view, it's the war-torn verse that doesn't get heard that much.
Mm. There's a video on your website where your version of God Save the Queen is accompanied by footage of the Queen's coronation. So are you a Canadian royalist?
I'm a Canadian. I'm mostly a citizen of the planet and a student of history, although it's just my own kind of history. I don't really have much to say about the truthfulness of anything that I'm doing. It's just my own reflection of history.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, the coronation was amazing. It was fantastic. The Queen was looking great. Everybody was in love with her. They had every piece of gold in the British Empire there. The carriage was amazing. It was just a very proud and beautiful time, and everybody was feeling really good.
Did you watch it? Did you remember watching that on television then?
I probably did see it, but, you know, television, it was 1952.
Right.
You got to remember, you know, even seeing a television was like very, very much a new thing. I don't think I even got a TV till like 1953 or 54.
You don't have any childhood memories of the coronation directly then?
Not that I can recall. In the words of many politicians.
I was lying in a burned-out basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head and I felt like getting.
You emerged as part of
the counterculture in the late 60s, playing at Woodstock and singing about environmental concerns after the gold rush and so on. But your politics have become sharpened in recent years, particularly in opposition to the Iraq war.
Well, I think I'm not a big fan of war. I think there's a place for it, I guess, if you have to stand up when people attack you. And I also think that, you know, like if people appear to be lying or appear to be misleading, then, you know, that's fair game. You can mention that.
And you called them out. You did that on the album Living with War a few years back, and you sang Let's Impeach the President, a song aimed directly at George W. Bush. But elsewhere on that album, and I think it was in the song Looking for a Leader, you suggested the name Obama as the next president. And that was 3 years, I think, probably before Obama was elected, at a time when he was still regarded as a rank outsider. And you called that right.
Oh, that was a fluke. Carpet bombing, you know.
No, but you only know there were only two names in that song. It was Obama and Colin Powell. And if I remember rightly, you said Obama regards himself as too young and Colin Powell possibly should be elected to right the wrongs he's done. The rhyme was something like that, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Maybe it's Obama, but he thinks that he's too young.
I'd met the future president at that time, and I'd seen him speak, and he was reflecting what a lot of Americans felt. He was quite a powerful force, and he still is.
And you said at that time that you had been reluctant to sing those kind of songs, protest songs. You were waiting for somebody of a younger generation to do that, but then you almost had to do it for them.
Well, Britney Spears didn't do it, so somebody had to.
So it's you and Bruce Springsteen, the angriest men in American rock now.
I hope not. If you ever watch, I don't know if you watch those American Idol or one of those. What are they? Do you have one of those?
Yeah,
over there?
X Factor
started in England, didn't
it? Yeah, Simon Cowell. Blame him.
Yeah. Okay, so you know, don't you have? I'm sure there's a lot of heavy-duty protesters on those shows, right? I mean, don't they have, you know? Do you have a young Bob Dylan out there somewhere?
It's not encouraged, believe it or not.
You're kidding.
No.
Are you kidding?
No.
That's so un-British.
It's incredible, isn't it? The great tradition of the...
I'm shocked.
The, yeah.
You're blowing my mind over here.
But seriously, though, I mean, does it worry you that there is not more political engagement, that people aren't addressing some of these issues? I mean, I'm thinking back to 1970, when those students were shot at Kent State University, you immediately went into the studio with Crosby and Stills and Nash, and you recorded that song, Ohio, one of the great protest songs of all time, one of the great pieces of music of all time, I think. It was doing something. You got that record out within, what, a week? Where's the equivalent today?
Social networking can overtopple governments. I mean, there is a big equivalent. You know, the only problem with the internet and social networking and everything that's happening is that the music is not reflected in its true glory. It is like wallpaper. And, you know, if I have my way and I can bring quality back to digital music so people can really hear it and feel it, most important, feel the music. So that you want to listen to it over and over and over again, the same song, because you never get to hear it all, because there's so much in it that your body just craves more. It's like good food compared to fast food. It's all served as the lowest common denominator. I see this as a tremendous opportunity for the history of music for someone to come along and create a music service that actually delivers what the musicians are making to the people.
Haven't you invented your own? Haven't you been working on this?
Yes, I have. So I have a startup company, and that's one of the things that I'm preparing to do. I'm actually, we're building our prototypes right now and creating our music service websites.
And it will work. It will be a form of music, digital delivery, that can capture the proper depth.
It will capture whatever the artist created will be exactly reproduced.
Oh, man. Look at my life, 24 and there's so much more. Live alone in a paradise that makes me think of two. Love lost, such a cost. Give me things that don't get lost, like a coin that won't get tossed, rolling home to you.
Your albums, I mean, particularly those from the 70s, we think about After the Gold Rush or Harvest, regarded as timeless classics. People will always play those records. I mean, in a way, here you are recording American folk songs. Some of those songs that you have written, many of them, will be the folk songs of the future. Do you ever think of them like that? Or, you know, are you always looking to your next song rather than looking back?
Well, you know, and I don't think of them at all in that respect. It's just another record to me. I don't really, you know, I know it was more successful than the other records, but that was my time to shine. Everybody has a time to be first for them. That was my time to be first for me. What matters is the next thing. And you're really only as good as the last thing you did.
You worried in particular, I think, about Harvest, didn't you? Because you thought it was taking you to the middle of the road. There was a great quote from that time that you said, you've been to the middle of the road, but you'd rather stay in the ditch. You'll meet more interesting people there.
Yeah, but I've been back to the middle of the road, too. I mean, you know, at the time, you know, it's a changing picture every day, you know. The idea is just, as in life, to try not to just repeat yourself until further notice, you know.
And do you replenish yourself musically every few years by slipping between the styles, from the beautiful, tender balladry to the sort of thing you've been doing this year with Crazy Horse? Is that a conscious decision?
No. I try to feel what's happening inside me and what I need to do as an artist to express myself. And, you know, I try to be true to that. And if I listen to that voice inside of me that tells me when it's time to stop doing one thing and time to start doing another, you never argue with that. If you listen to your inner voice in anything, whether it's music or life or a relationship, if you just listen, your soul tells you what to do. It's a very simple thing. You just have to believe.
I think it's fantastic the way that you have relentlessly looked forward, and it's kept you relevant through these decades. But there is an obligation always, I guess, when you're playing live with whichever band, to give the fans something of the past. They pay a lot of money to see those shows. And
that's their problem.
What, of paying
to see?
We have
to play what we have to play. When people buy a ticket to come and see me or me and Crazy Horse or whatever it is, you know, sometimes I'm into pleasing people and sometimes I'm not.
So you never feel that obligation
I was talking about. Sometimes I feel it, sometimes I don't.
Right. Have you spent the last 45 years or so just playing for yourself, first and foremost, then?
You know, I think that I'm pretty selfish. Music demands that you play for the music. So that's what I try to do. But, you know, I try to please people in my own way. And, you know, I hope people enjoy the shows that you know, they don't always get what they want, but, you know. Sometimes they get what they need. Who was that? Mick Jagger said that? You know, so that's what happens.
Your voice is so distinctive. The guitar playing has remained largely unchanged over the decades. So has the songwriting process, has that changed at all? Has that evolved over the years?
I don't think so. I believe that the first thing you will hear in the morning when you wake up is probably the most important thing you're going to hear all day. Because you've been working on it all night and you didn't even know it. So Whatever naturally happens is okay with me. And if I have something on my mind, it may come out in the song. Sometimes the songs are terrible. Sometimes I play them anyway.
Just finally, there's a British artist called Jeremy Deller who's had a show on recently. And one of his artworks is a poster. And it just has the words, "What would Neil Young do?" Do you always know what to do in whichever situation?
No, I never know what to do. Do you...
So you're always you're thinking, what would Bob Dylan do? Or what would somebody else do?
Well, I do think about that sometimes, but, you know, I know he doesn't know what to do either, so it really doesn't help.
Neil Young, thank you very much.
All right, thanks. Bye.